This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. Counter-protesters outnumbered white supremacists at yesterday's Unite the Right rally in Washington. New revelations from former presidential adviser Omarosa Manigault Newman. Another week in the Paul Manafort trial. The latest on Brett Kavanaugh's SCOTUS confirmation. Alex Jones blocked on social media. And the midterms. This hour, On Point, a look ahead at the big stories of the week. You can join us on air or online. Did you participate in one of yesterday's rallies in Washington, Charlottesville, or elsewhere? Tell us what you saw. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter at Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox, focusing on conservatism and the American right. You can find a link to her story, What Sunday's Unite the Right 2 Rally Tells Us About the State of the Alt-Right in America, at our website, onpointradio.org. Jane, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Molly Ball is the national political correspondent for Time. You can find a link to her story, Stacey Abrams Could Become America's First Black Female Governor If She Can Turn Georgia Blue, at our website, onpointradio.org. Molly, welcome back to On Point to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Seungmun Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. You can find a link to her story. Trump condemns all types of racism after a week of racially tinged remarks. That, too, is at our website, onpointradio.org. Seungmun, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you to all three of you. Let's start with the rally that really wasn't much of a rally. Seungmun, what was your take on what happened yesterday in D.C.?
Well, you're completely right that what the kind of the turnout that we had expected from the white nationalist side, which was about 400 people, that's at least what the organizers had estimated when they applied for park permits, was already going to be dwarfed by the counter protesters. We knew that these counter protesters would be out in the thousands in D.C. But what was a surprise, or maybe not a surprise, but what did happen at this rally in Washington is that there were, I mean, by all media accounts, fewer than 40 people from this white nationalist crowd to show up. I think that was just a kind of the stark reminder of how prevalent and how not prevalent this kind of the sentiment is, particularly a year after the Charlottesville incident.
Jane, you tweeted recently about the white nationalists, and I quote here from your tweet: "They are concerned about the optics that a movement made up of anti-Semites and racists might appear to be a movement of anti-Semites and racists."
Right.
How does that play into what you saw yesterday?
So it plays in a lot, because I think that the real story of the rally is that everyone hates Jason Kessler, including other members of the alt-right and white nationalists, because Jason Kessler has been very worried about the optics of what this movement looks like. You'll notice that he, on the Unite the Right website, it said that people could only bring either American flags or Confederate flags to avoid the Nazi flags of last year. And there very much was a concern that, you know, they wanted to be able to share their message of anti-Semitism and racism while appearing to be clean cut and, you know, like average Americans, so to speak. But that also has made him very unpopular with the far right elements of, you know, of these groups, who think that this is kind of giving in. And that, you know, it's best to be just straightforward with their beliefs in the hope that that will get other people on board. Whereas I think Kessler's perspective more is, you know, let's try and get this terminology, let's kind of get these ideas into mainstream media, as if, you know, they, by looking more mainstream, they can make their, you know, racist and anti-Semitic ideas more mainstream. But
the expression I heard yesterday from a former white nationalist from years ago, that he expressed, was essentially suits, not boots.
Exactly. Yeah. But the issue is you need to have enough suits, and sure, that's not what they had yesterday.
Jason Kessler was the organizer of yesterday's Unite the Right rally in D.C. Here's what he told reporters about his motives.
I'm not here to celebrate the tragedies that happened last year. What I'm here to do is tell the truth about what happened in Charlottesville, which has been kept from the public, that the Charlottesville government sabotaged that event. They violated the civil rights of everybody who came out there, from my side, from the other side.
Kessler went on to say that people, and specifically white people, are scared to stand up for their rights. Molly Ball, it seems to me there is still a question of the ongoing effect of that quote, very fine people on both sides, stemming from Charlottesville last year. And yet we read polls in which President Trump, with his supporters, is more popular than ever. From a national standpoint, where are we in terms of what happened last year and starting to get the ramifications of what happened yesterday?
Well, I think there is a bit of a contradiction, as you point out, that on the one hand, this the original rally, it was called Unite the Right because the idea was to bring together mainstream conservatives and the alt-right and the most fringe and openly racist and openly anti-Semitic members of that movement. The idea was to bring them all together. And what it has done instead is to really fracture, particularly the alt-right. And a number of people from last year's rally lost jobs and so on. People don't want to be associated with Kessler and his group and his movement. On the other hand, it can be argued in a terrific essay by my former colleague Adam Serwer in The Atlantic argues that what has actually happened is that a lot of these alt-right sentiments have been mainstreamed and they have become acceptable because Trump has sort of validated with sentiments like the some very fine people has communicated to his supporters that this stuff is okay. And because those supporters are pretty much unconditional supporters of Trump and continued to support him through this through the original controversy, that they, too, have signaled their acceptance of some of these sentiments. So I think that both of those things can be true. It can be true that on the one hand, the actual organizers of this particular protest aren't doing so well, but that a lot of the things that they espoused have come to seem more acceptable.
In other words, why do I need to go out into the street where everything is videoed, as it was last year in Charlottesville and is pretty much everywhere these days, and potentially lose my job when some of the things that I am espousing or I believe in are starting to leak into the, not just leak into it, but be in the public conversation or the political conversation, regardless of whether I'm in the street or not?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the original members of the Ku Klux Klan wore robes because they did not want to become, they didn't want to be known for their beliefs. And the Unite the Right ralliers were sort of saying that that this stuff is even more acceptable now than it was then. I think they found that, they found that not to be the case. They found that people who saw them out with, you know, their tiki torches or whatever did not want to associate with those kinds of beliefs.
Sungmin, is there a notion of how closely the White House was watching what was happening yesterday?
It's unclear how closely the president himself was watching the events of yesterday, but you can't ignore kind of all these. In the week leading up to the Charlottesville anniversary, the president seemed to find himself in the middle, whether he caused it himself or, you know, his allies or former allies in the case of Omarosa and Manigault Newman, how he found himself in the middle of a lot of racial controversies in the week before. I mean, he started his 11-day what they called a working vacation up in Bedminster, with a tweet attacking LeBron James and Don Lemon, two prominent African-American men, for their intelligence. When he went to a rally in Ohio for Troy Balderson, that Republican candidate in the special election in Ohio, he, and this is a frequent attack, but he attacked Maxine Waters, a prominent black lawmaker who has been a critic of President Trump and calling her low IQ and all these attacks that he has leveled on her before. And just 2 days before the Charlottesville anniversary, he went on the attack again on the NFL and the players who kneel during the national anthem to protest, you know, racial profiling, police brutality, and other related issues. It's interesting. The White House aides tell us at the Washington Post that the president actually likes the attack on the NFL. He thinks it gets part of his base going, who see this as an issue of patriotism and respect for the flag, whereas, you know, the players are, you know, protesting, you know, something. They're not, it's not an issue of patriotism. They're protesting these injustices that they've seen in their everyday life. So you do see how just all these controversies that the president, you know, did find himself in, even though he was relatively quiet publicly on the issue himself. I was up in Bedminster. We didn't see him a lot while we were up there. And, you know, it wasn't until late Friday night, I believe, that he mentioned the Charlottesville issue, condemning, quote, all types of racism on the anniversary, which did have some echoes of his comments last year when he said, you know, there were very fine people on both sides and that both sides should be held responsible for the violence.
Jane, I have to believe, well, first of all, critics of the president have been waiting for him via Twitter to criticize Nazis as emotionally and as passionately as he has the NFL players. And I don't think they're going to be satisfied at any point soon with a tweet along those lines. But I'll give the last word on this segment to you. And that is, much was made in D.C. about, well, is there going to be actually a train on the subway specifically for the white nationalists who are speaking? And should we really give them they're out in their own train or their own car in a train? They didn't come out with an official policy of that, but essentially there was a tremendous amount of police and security there to make sure that nothing happened. And I have to believe behind closed doors, D.C. officials were saying, doesn't matter what it costs, we must make sure that nothing happens so that our name is not synonymous with an event as Charlottesville is now.
Right. And I think it's also important to remember that the land on which the rally was taking place is federal land. You know, so you were already involving National Park Service, you were involving United States Secret Service, but as the White House is directly across the street, and, you know, city police. So I think that that coordinated effort, and after last year, I think that they really saw that, you know, whatever they needed to do, as you said, to prevent that from happening again, they were willing to do.
Jane, stay with us. All three of you, please stay with us. We're discussing the weekend's news and what it all means for the upcoming week. You can join the conversation. What are you watching for in the Manafort trial this week? Are you watching? What do you make of former presidential advisor Omarosa Manigault saying the president is racist? I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're looking ahead at the week's big stories in Washington and the world. You can join the conversation. What did you make of the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, saying that President Trump and former FBI Director James Comey never talked about Michael Flynn? Is Giuliani helping or hurting the president when it comes to the Mueller investigation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guests today are Sungmin Kim, a White House reporter for The Washington Post, Molly Ball, the national political correspondent for Time, and Jane Costin, a senior reporter at Vox. One of the other big stories out of D.C. this weekend, the appearances on television of Omarosa Manigault Newman. She spoke to NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, and the former White House advisor said she regretted some of her past support for President Trump.
I was complicit with this White House deceiving this nation. They continue to deceive this nation by how mentally declined he is, how difficult it is for him to process complex information, how he is not engaged in some of the most important decisions that impacts our country. I was complicit, and for that, I regret.
Jane, we'll start with you. What is the importance of the story, if any, or is it, as her detractors would say, a person trying to sell a book?
I think that there's a lot of both. I think this is definitely a person trying to sell a book, but also, you know, the fact that she may have recorded John Kelly in the Situation Room, which is a, you know, it's a secure facility. I feel that that's an important part of the story because that's a massive security breach. However, you know, it's interesting that we talk both about Omarosa and Paul Manafort. These are people, you know, they did not wind up in Trump's inner circle by accident. He hired them. You know, this was, you know, these were two people who were widely known to perhaps not be the best addition to either a presidential campaign or a presidential administration. And yet the president thought otherwise. And I think that that is an interesting part of the story. But, you know, there is also the element of trying to sell a book.
We have a comment from our website from N. Steph, who writes, "The Situation Room is supposed to be devoid of personal electronic devices because it's a totally secure area for the planning and discussions of grave national security issues and military operations. It's not the place to discuss a personnel issue, even a dismissal. Doesn't the chief of staff have a private office for this? Only in the Trump administration would this absurd behavior even occur," writes N. Steph on our website. Molly, shall we chalk this up to the latest example of, for want of a better term, the new normal? Anything that you thought might never occur in the past is happening now.
Well, we've known from the start that this was a highly chaotic White House, full of, shall we say, non-traditional personalities for government. And that indeed was part of the promise and the appeal of Trump as a candidate, that he would do things differently, in some cases radically differently. And the whole feeling that rules didn't apply to him and could just be smashed may yet turn out to have consequences. But it is certainly something that was always a feature of his personality. I've thought a lot since the beginning of this administration about the larger meaning of all of this palace intrigue, as the White House likes to call it. And I think there is a significance to it, just because I think that the style of management is very much the style of governance. And you see a president who calls foreign leaders on his cell phone, also a security issue and also a breach of traditional protocol, who, you know, goes into negotiations by himself with Vladimir Putin, does all kinds of stuff seemingly on the spur of the moment. And that is the way he likes to operate. He has a much higher tolerance for chaos, I think, than most human beings, with the possible exception of Omarosa Manigault Newman, who is herself a very big personality and who was brought into the White House personally by Donald Trump, has a long personal relationship with him, and is an interesting sort of bridge from Trump's reality TV career to his presidency. And I would point out a couple of developments just this morning. Trump, as we're on the air, has been tweeting more about Omarosa. He said that, you know, she was really nasty to people and would miss work all the time, and that, you know, she begged for a job in the White House. His most recent tweet says, "I know it's, quote, not presidential to take on a lowlife like Omarosa. I would rather not be doing so. The fake news media will be working overtime to make even wacky Omarosa look legitimate as possible." Right. And Omarosa was on television this morning with a new tape that appears to be the president himself calling her and claiming that he didn't know after she was fired that Kelly had dismissed her.
And this comes in the aftermath of her being on television Sunday with a tape of General Kelly, essentially the tape of her firing. With all this talk of tapes, it seems like it's 1973, 1974. All over again, different subject, obviously. Omarosa Manigault Newman told NBC's Chuck Todd on Meet the Press yesterday that she's heard evidence that President Trump used the N-word while working on his reality show, The Apprentice.
You have heard the tape.
I have heard
since publication of this book.
Absolutely.
So you know it exists.
And I know it exists. And what I regret is that these people are probably trying to leverage it as this October surprise. I don't want to be a part of that. But I have heard for 2 years that it existed, and once I heard it for myself, it was confirmed what I feared the most, that Donald Trump is a con and has been masquerading as someone who is actually open to engaging with diverse communities. But when he talks that way, the way he did on this tape, it confirmed that he is truly a racist.
Jane, let's say this tape surfaces, and that's a big what if, that's a hypothetical, but there have been so many occasions over the past year, two, three, be you a supporter of the president or not, where something would occur and we would think, well, in the old days, there would be such a huge reaction to that and ramifications. Would there be ramifications from this if it came out, or would his supporters just continue to support him and his detractors continue to criticize him?
Well, I think it's critical to note that the important group we're talking about in terms of how a tape like this or a different tape that would do say something about the president, you know, there are two different groups who we're talking about. We're talking about Trump's base, and we're talking about kind of reluctant, less committed Trump supporters. You know, and you know, his popularity within the GOP is very high, but that's a lot because of the economy. And a lot of times people do not pay attention to the day-to-day politics to the degree that we do. But I think that, so I think that with Trump's committed base, I think that there's no impact any potential tape could really have on their support, because their support is largely baked in at this point and has been for a long time. However, I think for, say, you know, Republicans who weren't on the Trump bandwagon but have grown in their warmth to him because of the economy and because of things that they like, specifically about, say, deregulation, I think that a tape could shift their feelings, but it might not shift them away from Trump, but it might make them less vociferous in their support, so to speak. You know, I think that that's an important issue here, is that, you know, when we're looking in advance of the primaries or we're looking in advance of 2020, what you're, you know, it's not so much the people who are completely bought in. It's the people who could, you know, could leave or could stay in terms of continuing to vote for the president and the GOP.
Let's go to your phone calls now. Gwyn is calling from South Korea. Gwyn, you're on Point.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Good.
How are you doing? I just really want to ask a question about that. You know, even, you know, with this economic benefits that Donald Trump had created, I think, you know, what lots of people do to his morality and his, you know, what dissonance between what he actually preached and what he actually practiced in reality. Lots of disillusioned people, just like Omarosa, Marigold, and Newman, they're actually coming out and they're realizing there has been a significant chasm existing between their ideals and the reality in terms of President Donald Trump. And I just wonder, you know, what, to what direction and people might seek their exit, like, you know, mass exodus, you know, who looking for their next, you know, savior who might actually carry their political cross.
Mm-hmm. In other words, who will Trump supporters direct their anger at next, perhaps? Molly, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, you know, I think that there are a couple of interesting wrinkles here. The election that I'm the most focused on is the midterms that are coming up. And there, Trump will not be on the ballot, but everyone in the Republican Party who is on the ballot, the Congress and so on, are concerned about the effect that he's having on them. As the caller noted, we are experiencing economic conditions that any other president would probably be benefiting from to the tune of a soaring approval rating. And it is, I think, because of Trump's personal behavior that he is quite unpopular, despite the fact of a record stock market and record unemployment. So it's clear that, you know, the president, he is quite unpopular. We talk a lot about how durable the sort of floor of his support is because of the supporters who will never leave him. But he is quite unpopular, particularly for a president so early in his term, and particularly for a president enjoying the conditions that he does. And the Republicans who are going to be on the ballot this fall worry that, exactly as Jane was saying, a lot of traditional Republican voters, even though they see the difference between Trump and the congressional party, they're just worn out and discouraged and aren't very enthusiastic about going out and voting for more of this pattern, whereas the Democratic base appears quite motivated.
In fact, quickly before we get on to our next topic, Molly, you wrote recently that the paradigmatic, not a word, by the way, I use every day, the paradigmatic voter of 2018 isn't the Trump-loving blue-collar white guy. This is from your one of your recent articles. It's the suburban mom who can't stand Betsy DeVos. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Yeah, well, if there is any kind of blue wave this fall, it will be made of women. We've seen since Trump was elected just an outpouring of women's activism, from the Women's March to the enormous numbers of women who have signed up to run for office. Previously, women in politics activists talked about how hard it was to get women to agree to run. Now they're just coming out of the woodwork. Nearly half of the Democratic nominees for congressional seats are women. That is by far a record. Women have been winning Democratic primaries at a quite disproportionate rate. The same dynamic does not apply on the Republican side, although they do have many qualified female candidates. It is that woman voter, particularly college-educated women voters, have just swung dramatically against the president. They strongly disapprove of him in polls, and they appear quite motivated to send a message.
And then, of course, there is the Russia probe. The president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, told CNN's State of the Union Sunday that the Mueller investigation should be over by September 1st.
We shouldn't be carrying on this investigation any longer than we have to. It can get done by early September. They have all the information they need to write a report and either clear the president, raise questions, do whatever they want to do.
Of course, what we're not hearing here is anybody from the Mueller investigation commenting, because they don't do that. Rudy Giuliani has, it's open season for him, as is his right, to talk about this and say whatever he'd like. But of course, there's been a seal, essentially, on the Mueller investigation from the prosecutors in the Mueller investigation. Having said that, Jane, the timing of this does get interesting in terms of when to release the report. Do you release it? Can it be released a week before the election? Is that seen as falling into the same trap as what happened with Comey in terms of releasing stuff before the election? What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say, because there's only one side, as you said, that really talks, and it's not Robert Mueller. The Mueller kind of investigation has been so closed off, which I think, from a legal perspective, it's very smart. But from a political perspective, I think that gets challenging, because the only message we're hearing is from, the president and the president's associates and the president's attorney. But I do think that the political considerations are not something that Mueller is thinking about. I think that's something that's, definitely on the front of mind for Rudy Giuliani. But again, when Rudy Giuliani says, I think the investigation should be over by September 1st, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean the investigation will be over by September 1st. That doesn't mean the investigation could be over by September 1st.
Right.
So
as I understand it, the last time a prosecutor gave in to, here are the specific times where we're going to end the investigation, was never. So,
right, exactly. So I think that this is a lot of wish casting by Giuliani without, and of course the Mueller campaign is not, or the, Mueller's team is not going to respond.
Of course. When we discuss the Mueller probe, we discuss the Manafort trial almost in tandem, and we'll move to that now as it goes into yet another week, and we head back to your phone calls. Sarah is calling from Zion, Illinois. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Bud. In light of everything you're talking about, the racism that I see every day in my town, which is a mixture of Black, Latino, and white, and the comments, there's so much Trump support here, and I've heard really extreme racist comments ever since I lived here 10 years ago. And the Russian collusion, which I think has been established, and the Russian influence on our elections, the incompetence and madness in the White House, all these details we're talking about, I feel have been pretty well established. And I feel like what we need to do, the focus of people who want to change things, needs to be on how to ensure that our elections this November will be legitimate. With all the Russian influence, with the insecurity of computer voting, with the voter suppression, how can we do this? We need to focus on that.
Thank you for your call, Sarah. Sungmin, I'll hand this to you. It does seem like in this incredibly divided age, there is at least some notion of bipartisan agreement that the Russians were involved in 2016, and there's an effort to be involved in 2018. What do you see day to day on the ground?
I think definitely on Capitol Hill, there is a set. I mean, it is almost basically unanimous on Capitol Hill, the view that Russia did interfere in the 2016 elections to benefit the Trump campaign. Everybody on Capitol Hill, it seems, buys the intelligence community's assessment of that election. And a lot of lawmakers are raising concerns ahead of the 2018 elections about whether the election systems will be secure in time. And now but that's not the message that we see from the president himself, who himself has a different message from his own administration officials. Recall that really kind of dramatic show of force from his top national security officials in the White House press briefing room a couple of weeks ago, when you had the FBI director, the director of national intelligence, come up and talk about the importance of election security. That's not the message that the president had in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin when he said he wouldn't take the opportunity to tell Putin not to do it in 2018, and he cast doubt on the 2016 intelligence assessment.
All three of you, Sungmin, Jane, Molly, please stand by. We're looking forward and breaking down the big stories coming up this week. You can join the conversation. We'll talk a bit more about the Manafort trial. How should social media platforms handle controversial figures like Alex Jones? Is banning them a violation of free speech? I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So you just woke up, and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're gearing up for another busy week of news by talking with three top reporters about the stories they're following. You can join the conversation. What do the close elections in Ohio and Kansas tell you about the upcoming midterm elections? We've heard the terms blue wave, a red tide. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guests today are Molly Ball, the national political correspondent for Time, Jane Costin, a senior reporter at Vox, and Sungmin Kim, a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Sungmin, I believe it was you who yesterday tweeted, there is nothing more I love than an 88,000-page document dump on Sunday mornings, referring to the documents connected to the potential next Supreme Court justice. What did you see? And I'm assuming you read every single word of all 88,000 pages. That sounds like a fun Sunday to me.
Luckily, we have a large enough team at the Washington Post where we each took about 10,000 pages, and they are as scintillating as you would expect a White House staffer's emails to be, which is not that much, at least in the portions that I saw. And these documents have become a real point of contention between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate over the confirmation, because the process by which these documents are being rolled out is quite unusual. It's a process that's being controlled mostly by aides to former President George W. Bush, from whom these records are from his presidential library. And Democrats are saying that's not a fair process. It should be a neutral arbiter, such as the National Archives, that controls that process. And they also point out that we are going to see even just a fraction of documents from his tenure at the White House, because Brett Kavanaugh worked in the Bush White House for 5 years. He was a counsel for 2 years, staff secretary for 3 of the years. And Republicans and the White House say the 3 years from the staff secretary, the 3 years from which Brett Kavanaugh was staff secretary, those documents are irrelevant to his nomination fight. Democrats and the public don't need to see him, whereas Democrats argue otherwise. But this documents fight, while it is getting very contentious and very partisan, doesn't become too relevant until it starts really swinging those key swing votes in the middle, who will determine whether the whether the president's nominee gets confirmed or not. And you've seen those are the kind of people that we're watching are Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who are these two critical Republican swing votes on, you know, almost sometimes virtually every issue. But they've shown an inclination so far to want to support Kavanaugh. They haven't found alarming things in his record. Clearly, they're going to reserve their judgment until after the confirmation hearings are held, which will be held in the first week of September. But we see them as potential likely yeses at this point, you know, barring a major last-minute surprise. Mm-hmm. And there is a good chance that Brett Kavanaugh picks up the support of at least three of these red state Democrats who hail from very Trump-friendly states who are on the ballot in November. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has already met with him. You know, sources familiar with the meeting told me after that meeting occurred about how much Kavanaugh stressed his independence to Manchin, which is kind of a key word for the senator who always tries to assert his independence from his own party and from the Republican Party as well. Brett Kavanaugh will also meet with two of these other key red state senators this week, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Joe Donnelly of Indiana. All three of them voted for Neil Gorsuch, and we expect them to at least very, you know, heavily consider confirming Kavanaugh this time. So we talk a lot about how this White House may botch a lot of things, whether it's personnel or legislative affairs or other issues. But on judicial nominations, particularly on the Supreme Court, the White House has done a very good job of making sure this process is as seamless as possible. And I think everyone is expecting Brett Kavanaugh to be confirmed probably by that first Monday in October.
Doesn't it essentially go back to the Trump line from the campaign about, you know, the Fifth Avenue? You could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. No matter what transpires, isn't there a core of Trump supporters who say, just get us the Supreme Court justices we want? Everything else is just outside noise.
I think that's exactly correct. And I think that's where, rewinding back a little bit, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's gambit to block the seat or keep open that seat for nearly a year after Justice Scalia passed away in February 2016 really paid off. For us watching at the time, that was a very audacious move. We thought blue state Republicans who were up for re-election that year would get massive political blowback for not considering President Barack Obama's final nominee to the Supreme Court. But all we saw is that that really energized a conservative base, and that energized Republicans who were skeptical about a Trump candidacy. You know, this was a man who used to be a Democrat and supported Roe versus Wade. That really, the combination of the open seat as well as the president, you know, in an unprecedented move, releasing this list of conservative justices he would nominate to the Supreme Court, really gave assurances to skeptical Republican voters and helped propel him to victory. If you looked at the exit polling after the race, after the 2016 campaign, you saw that voters who said the Supreme Court was much more important, was the top issue for them in the exit polling, they went for Donald Trump 2-1.
Right. Let's go back to your phone calls now. Mark is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Mark, thanks for joining us on Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't think I'm the only one who has not forgotten what McConnell and the Republicans did in the Senate in February 2016, blocking Obama's appointment, and what they did to the Constitution. There was nowhere in the Constitution to say you don't have presidential appointments in a quote-unquote election year. And, of course, the hypocrisy is so blatant now when McConnell can't, the Republicans can't wait to schedule the nomination process before the upcoming election. But it is really, especially coming from people who insist that they want to be conservative and interpret the Constitution as originalist and as it was originally meant, and they really twist it any way they need to when it suits their purposes. And I think that on long term, that is very bad for our country.
Molly, from a national standpoint, we talk about ramifications. And what would the ramification be during the campaign of the Access Hollywood tape? Or what would the ramifications be after Charlottesville? And at least with a certain part of the president's base, there don't seem to be ramifications. Again, with what happened with the President Obama's pick not getting a chance, and now what's going on now, do you think, albeit with that feeling out there, do you think there'll be any ramifications for this?
Well, you know, as Sungmin was saying, I think that it was a major motivator, particularly for evangelical Christians to support Trump, to think about this Supreme Court seat, because so many of the social issues and cultural issues that they are focused on could be decided by the Supreme Court. And so the nomination and confirmation of Neil Gorsuch and now potentially Brett Kavanaugh is one of the major things that feel like they have gotten what they voted for out of the Donald Trump presidency, that whether or not they like all the tweets and all the statements and all the behavior, that in a very material sense, that he kept their promise to them by nominating these conservatives. And if Kavanaugh is confirmed, it will swing the court in a quite conservative direction, because the justice that he's replacing was the swing vote on the court. And it is thought that Kavanaugh – now, all of this should be caveated with we don't know how he's going to rule on any particular case. They are not supposed to say that, and they generally take quite a lot of care not to. He does have a long paper trail of opinions and legal and political opinions that the committee is now sifting through, along with beleaguered reporters at The Washington Post. But, you know, the idea that it is for sure that Roe v. Wade is gone once Kavanaugh gets to the court, that's not true. And a lot of what these swing votes, the senators that Sungmin was talking about, a lot of what they're concerned about is receiving assurances that he is committed to upholding precedent, Roe v. Wade being a legal precedent, even if he doesn't necessarily agree with a decision, because it is the law of the land, and it's quite disruptive to go around overturning precedent unless there's quite good reason to. I think that's what you're going to hear the debate about a lot as these hearings begin next month. They've announced they're going to begin the hearings next month, unless, I suppose, there's enough of an outcry about these documents not being fully vetted that Democrats are able to succeed in getting that pushback.
Let's get a couple of other topics in quickly before the end of this segment. The Alex Jones story continues. Vimeo is the latest platform to pull its content, or the content posted by InfoWars. And, of course, the subject of censorship has been part of this conversation. Sungmin, we could all three of you and I could spend hours talking about this topic alone and the greater ramifications. But amongst your colleagues, what is the talk, or is there talk, about this particular topic?
Well, I think it's really interesting. So you saw Vimeo was the latest platform to remove Alex Jones's content. We've already seen Facebook, Apple, and YouTube. But the one platform that we haven't seen is Twitter. And you saw the Twitter CEO's explanation last week why they weren't removing this type of content, and saying, you know, our job is to put this information out there. And, you know, that's why we need a free and functioning press to kind of fact check everything. And there is a lot of, I mean, there was a lot of blowback from my fellow journalists on that assertion. I mean, we're not necessarily here to clean up the kind of the mess that Twitter causes. And I think that was a very fair point that journalists were making. So the interesting thing to me is just how different platforms have taken a different tack on this issue. But the majority do seem to feel that this is the kind of speech and the kind of content that should not be allowed to spread on platforms. And what Twitter does in the coming days, if they do kind of recalibrate their decision in response to the backlash, would be interesting to watch.
Jane, years ago when you were at Michigan, you did a thesis about Nazi propaganda before and after the Battle of Stalingrad. That is a bit far afield right now, but you even talked in a tweet this weekend about your knowledge of Nazi propaganda and also the music of Bob Marley, and how you wish more people would basically talk to you about the music of Bob Marley. Throwing out Nazi stuff is a dangerous game and a slippery slope. But you do have knowledge about how propaganda is used. I'm not saying this is propaganda, but I'm asking, does that give you a particular angle on this subject and how we should approach the notion of what is okay to print and to put out in social media and what is not?
Well, I think to start out, you know, I definitely want to draw a very big demarcation between Nazi propaganda and, you know, Alex Jones and the subjects that we're talking about. But I do think that conspiracy theories that, you know, upon which a lot of Nazi propaganda depended and helped to propagate, you know, they work the same way in 2018 that they did in, say, 1937, in that, you know, there is an other to which you need to be, of which you need to be very worried and concerned, and that, you know, you dehumanize the other, and that, you know, what is the, you come up with things that, you know, what's the absolute worst thing you could say about the other, or, you know, the object of your enmity. And so I think that, you know, and conspiracy theories also are about creating order in a chaotic world. And, you know, it's important to note when Alex Jones has appeared in court for, you know, for personal reasons, most recently his divorce, he attempted to portray himself as a performance artist, saying that, you know, he doesn't actually believe this stuff, but it's like an acting thing. But then at the same time, he wants to portray himself as, you know, the only person telling you the truth. And I think that, you know, that's not terribly uncommon with a lot of people who put forward a lot of conspiracy theories, is this desire to be both, you know, I don't actually believe this, but I actually believe this, which is a difficult road to walk. But I would say that, you know, the same kind of propagandistic images and ideas that we've seen, you know, you've seen put through by, you know, fascist regimes and, you know, Marxist regimes as well. Those same images and ideas are very, you can see throughout a lot of what Alex Jones talks about, especially, you know, when he talks about how there's a quote unquote Jewish mafia that controls the media, or his, you know, his laser focus on George Soros, who, you know, if you listen to Alex Jones, you believe that George Soros is a Nazi. George Soros survived the Holocaust as a child, and, you know, is a Hungarian Jew. And so I think that a lot of those same motifs that you see in Nazi propaganda and in fascist propaganda in general are still highly visible throughout a lot of the kind of conspiratorial far right.
Molly, we have obviously midterm elections is a story that we continue to follow, but we have some primaries coming up this week. What are you looking for?
Well, the primary season is starting to wind down. I think myself and a lot of my colleagues, we always look to primaries to give us a litmus test of where the parties are, since they are partisan voters choosing what they want to put forward as the face of the party. The signals have been really mixed, frankly, in a lot of these different contests, both on the Republican side, where there is a mix of sort of, there's a decided theme of candidates strongly supporting Trump, and Trump has been a bit of a kingmaker. We still don't know who won the Republican primary last week in Kansas after a late endorsement of the controversial challenger, Chris Kobach. That continues to be too close to call. On the Democratic side, we're also reading these tea leaves, looking at what is the mood of the National Democratic grassroots. And we've seen, I think a lot of us expected Democratic primaries to be a contest between, you know, the sort of Bernie faction and the Hillary faction, and to break down along sort of establishment versus liberal. But what's really been happening is there's a wide variety of different types of Democratic candidates winning these primaries. The only theme is that women are winning. Women candidates, whether they are more establishment or more liberal, are disproportionately getting Democratic nominations. So we'll be looking for all of those themes as the last few states continue to hold their primaries.
About 20 seconds. Is there a momentum to what happens this week that has an effect going forward? Or as in a sports season, does each game just exist unto itself?
Well, you know, each state has primary at a different time. So I don't think what happens in one state is going to influence what happens in another necessarily, not like a presidential primary, right, where they are sort of sequential. But I do think that a lot of progressive organizers are focused on these primaries as looking to see how they can increase turnout, how they can get Democrats more motivated.
Molly, thank you. Sorry to cut you off. Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Molly, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jane Costin is a senior reporter at Vox. Jane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Seungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Seungmin, pleasure having you.
Thanks for having me.
The conversation continues. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.